about Chippendales as the guys in cuffs and collars, but very few people know about the kind of dark criminal history that created that brand.
We, your weather girl, and have we got news for you.
In doing the show and actually seeing the reaction of the audience, I realized the power of Chippendales.
Kumail Nanjiani stars in this new Hulu limited series, Welcome to Chippendales. Believe it or not, it's a true crime story.
You see on stage and it's really fun and enthralling. And then behind the scenes, it's literally murder.
The victim was shot to death in his office.
It was fun to sort of create this character who in most ways is a monster, but he genuinely loves his wife.
Are you having a good time?
Just not my kind of place. No offense.
Not my kind of place either.
And there weren't just women in the audience. There were crucial women involved behind the scenes in the success of Chippendales, the business.
What if Chippendales did, like, a Playboy Club thing? Cuffs and collars. Just like the bunnies. It could be a really classy touch.
He really starts going down the dark path.
One of the most bizarre murder-for-hire cases in the history of the FBI.
I always said, behind every billionaire is a dead body or two.
Welcome to Chippendales.
Won't you please welcome from Los Angeles, the world famous Men of Chippendales.
I think people are still fascinated with Chippendales today because it's just this perfect relic of the big, wild, and crazy 80s.
It was booze, sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Back in the 1980s, when Chippendales really blew up, it was a groundbreaking genre, giving women a taste of something that had never existed for them before.
Muscular men disrobing for an audience of women and kind of flipping the script in terms of what we usually think of as a strip club situation. Chippendales was that nobody ever stripped naked. The naughty bits were always covered.
A lot was going on in the 80s that made the moment just right for Chippendales. Feminism was on the upswing.
Women were making their own money, and the idea that women could go out and spend that hard-earned money, that was becoming more accepted.
Why don't you take it off?
It was a cathartic experience for women to be able to do this and have attractive men pay attention to them. It was a role reversal.
Too much? I told you it was going to be a wild night.
It was like an explosion of orgasms to hear these women screaming when these Chippendales men would enter the stage.
I would venture to say it's over 100,000 women have watched me take my clothes off in some form or fashion. I actually wait for applause when I take off my clothes in the shower now, but it doesn't come, but I wait for it.
Girls from all walks of life came.
The women made it.
You'd have to hold women back. Women would take their tops off.
My first night on stage, some woman took off all of her clothes and ran as fast as she could toward me. There was nothing in the handbook of what do you do when a completely naked woman runs at you full speed in the middle of your act.
You always got grabbed, you got mauled, you got pinched, you got pulled.
You'd have claw marks down the back.
They'd be waving the bills and going crazy.
Yeah! And then you grab them by the head and give her a nice kiss, and then she'll give you a dollar.
Let's give them a big round of applause!
And then the show would be over, and they were back to granny and grandma and mother. They were just sweet as could be. It was just like, for that 2 hours, they could just cut loose.
Every woman should do it at least one time in her life to say, I did it, and I loved it.
So to really understand the story of Chippendales, you've got to start with Steve Banerjee, the man who founded it.
A lot of people look at your business and say, it's a fad, it's a passing fancy.
lust has never been a passing fancy. I mean, it's not a fad, it's pretty much like a necessity.
In many ways, Chippendales is an American dream story.
Steve Banerjee is an immigrant from India. His name is actually Shoman Banerjee, and he decided to change it when he moved to America.
Steve left India in the early 1960s and then arrived in Los Angeles.
He had to teach himself English, and really was a rags-to-riches story.
I wanted to start a printing business, but I didn't have money to start it.
Steve's father owned a printing company back in India, but Steve realized if he wanted his own business, he was going to have to start from the bottom.
Steve Banerjee's first job was as a janitor.
But Steve was always looking for that next big thing. So he borrowed some money from a friend to open his first business.
He ended up opening a couple gas station franchises.
I know nothing about cars. I never had my hands dirty before.
His two role models are Hugh Hefner and Walt Disney. And he has this idea that he wants to create a kind of marquee American brand.
He sets his sights on the nightlife and the bright lights in the big city.
He buys this dumpy nightclub, which he goes on to call Destiny 2.
America's latest craze is disco dancing. Discomania is a $4 billion business.
When Steve opens Destiny 2, discotheques were a huge part of LA nightlife.
People starting to go out, dress up a little better, have a good time. There's all this music like Casey and the Sunshine Band. Kool and the Gang, tracks like Ladies Night.
When Steve opens Destiny 2, it is definitely not an overnight success. He's competing with a lot of other nightclubs in LA. Steve Banerjee would try anything. He threw so many things against the wall to see what would stick.
Make sure you put a lot of twists in that little shuffle step, everyone.
We did things like magic shows and dinner theater, whatever it took. We did mud wrestling. The floor was filthy. It was horrible. It was an idiot idea.
He had backgammon night.
Backgammon didn't take off because backgammon still hasn't taken off. It's not really a money-minting machine.
Destiny 2 is not catching on, and Steve and his business partners decide, okay, we are gonna rebrand the club. They land on the name Chippendales.
Come on, let's get going.
Which has nothing to do with Chip and Dale, the Disney characters. It has to do with Thomas Chippendale, the 18th century furniture designer. They had all of this knockoff Chippendale furniture in the club.
It has a nice catchy name to it. And in order to get a classy name,
Chippendales, just north of Venice Boulevard on Overland Avenue in West LA.
They are still having trouble getting people in the door. And then one day, in walks this man named Paul Snyder.
Paul Snyder was a ne'er-do-well entrepreneur from Canada who came to Los Angeles.
He was trying to make it as a club promoter. He was a hustler.
Paul just seemed like he was always trying to get away with something. You walk away from Paul and you feel like you need to take a shower.
Paul Snyder had apparently seen a gay male review where men were stripping for other men and suggested that Steve try out something like that for women. And Paul said there was one condition, he had to be the MC.
And Banerjee thought, wow, I could do male strippers. If it's bringing women in, it doesn't matter to me.
And I said, what? What a stupid, stupid idea. I said, this thing won't last a night.
Paul and Steve would go to the gyms, to the beaches, and see guys who they thought looked the part and ask them, hey, want to take your clothes off tonight at a club for women?
This is Chippendales, a nightclub exclusively for women.
The only men allowed in the club are the waiters, bartenders, and the male dancers.
The first night that the show opened, Steve told a local paper that 600 women showed up.
Are you excited about the idea of men taking their clothes off?
Excited! Oh! And how? I think it's great! I might just kick my husband out.
So, Banerjee just saw the receipts when he tried it the first time, and it just blew out the door.
What are you thinking right now?
What am I thinking? I'd like to see another show.
If you think about that first night when Lily Banerjee was just trying out another new idea, it is mind-blowing to think that this would transform ideas about women and men and sexuality, become an international phenomenon.
Steve Banerjee seems poised for success.
It really was a hot nightclub. The Playboy bunnies were there.
But there's trouble on the horizon.
A murder that will stun Chippendales.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's 1979, and one of Steve Banerjee's ideas for his club is finally sticking. It's a male strip review.
For years, there have been Playboy bunnies to delight men, but now Chippendales is gaining traction, and boy, does it take off.
I can feel to be a sex object.
I love it. Feels good.
Paul Snyder, who's in on this with Banerjee and is a fixture in the club scene, happens to be dating a Playboy playmate, Dorothy Strachan, and that brings Chippendales to the attention of Hugh Hefner.
Chippendales became a hangout for the in crowd at Hugh Hefner's mansion. If you drew a straight line from Hefner's mansion, it would lead directly to Chippendales.
And the story is that it's because of Dorothy and her connections to Hefner that that's why the Chippendales men wear the cuffs and collars, which of course are modeled after Playboy bunny costumes.
We have to wear just a collar and bow tie, and the girls seem to like it a lot.
You see, Banerjee and the Chippendales benefited from Snyder's connections, and it helped them make their mark on the scene.
But when it came to being part of the show, Paul Snyder just wasn't that good.
Paul was a horrible MC. He didn't have any interaction with the audience, jokes or whatever. The whole show stunk.
Steve Banerjee abruptly cans Paul.
Steve Banerjee edged the guy who brought the idea to him out of the picture and replaced him with somebody else, beginning a pattern of behavior that Steve Banerjee's business would become well known for.
I believe that being dismissed from Chippendales really made him feel very bitter. This, I think, was probably felt especially painfully because Dorothy's career was going so well.
In August of 1980, Dorothy had just been named Playmate of the Year. Her star is rising.
Then he lost Dorothy's heart to the film director Peter Bogdanovich. That drove him into a spiral of rage and jealousy so intense that he murdered Dorothy Stratton in 1980 and then turned the gun on himself.
Snyder apparently shot Stratton in the face with a 12-gauge shotgun. He then apparently turned the gun on himself.
I always thought it was interesting that the person who told Steve Banerjee you should have male strippers at your club is the same person who ends up committing this terrible crime.
While Snyder was no longer with Chippendales, it was one of the first dark instances to be associated with this brand. In retrospect, there was also more darkness brewing at this time, which is going to rear its ugly head much later. While Steve's club is taking off, he's not relishing the spotlight.
Steve Banerjee was known to be a little bit socially awkward.
He was always in the shadows. He would never be comfortable front and center.
Steve is incredibly private. He's dating a woman he's eventually going to marry, but she's rarely seen at the club.
He never talked about his personal family. He lived business 24/7. He never had an MBA, but he knew accounting and he knew marketing like inside out. And he was constantly thinking of ways to make Chippendales better success, bigger success.
Steve was driven by money. It was all about money.
It was money and to be the best.
What does Steve Banerjee do with all his money, all this newfound wealth?
I wonder half of the time that when I write my checks, what happened to the money I made the last month? It just goes back into business.
As you might imagine, by no means was Chippendales a buttoned-up corporate atmosphere.
Steve Banerjee was very competitive. He wanted to make the most money out of any nightclub in LA. A lot of the choices he would end up making came out of that sense of competition.
The fire code capacity was 299.
But he would get 600 girls in there at a time, nightly.
More women in the club meant more money for Steve Banerjee.
Rules don't apply to Steve. He wouldn't care about laws.
The LAPD raided the place twice.
Steve Banerjee realized that every time he got in the news for overcrowding, the club was even more packed the next night. And so rumor has it, he plays some of those complaints about overcrowding on himself with the cops.
As the saying goes, no publicity is bad publicity. No fire code violations can keep Chippendales down.
I'll have to tell them how fantastic it is.
In 1981, Steve has his eye on expanding Chippendales beyond the LA club scene.
There enters on the scene a man who really changes the direction of Chippendales. His name is Nick DeNoia.
The meeting of Steve Banerjee and Nick DeNoia was the beginning of so much that nobody saw coming. It was an incredibly fateful meeting.
Nick comes out of the theater world of New York, and he is an Emmy Award-winning children's television producer. His claim to fame is that he makes this kids' TV series called Unicorn Tales.
Once upon a time, in the here and the now, there came to Unicorn City a boy named Andy.
All very questionable resume lines to become a male strip impresario.
Nick came in and I think put stars in Steve Banerjee's eyes, telling him he would create a show that would create buzz, it would bring in cash, and that Nick could create something that would get Chippendales to Broadway.
I think Nick saw, what if we had lights, what if we had real choreography, what if we had costumes? This could be huge.
It was not going to be just about men stripping. He knew that women needed romance. He knew that women needed story.
As Chippendales was gaining in popularity, Nick was the subject of a number of local news pieces. He told Evening Magazine his plans to make the show appealing to women.
We go to see a strip show. As soon as a woman takes off her bra, we're dirty-minded little boys. With women, it's not that. They'll get turned on by a man, but they have to know that personality.
Nick's show revolved around characters for each of the men.
The Barbarian.
A new man for a new world.
Zorro.
His symbol, a single red rose.
The Perfect Man.
The Perfect Man!
He trained them. They had rehearsals.
Nobody scared me like he scared me. He was so unaccepting of anything less than perfection.
I'm easy. As I say to them, gentlemen, if you give me what I want, I'm a sweetheart.
He really pushed you and pushed you. That's how Chippendales became Chippendales.
We were expected to eat a certain way, train, stay in shape.
If you showed up not looking right, or your spandex pants were a little muffin top going on, you'd hear from Nick.
They became stars instead of strippers.
Ah, yes, just like Broadway, isn't it?
Within the next 2 years, Nick's vision takes the show to a whole new level, bringing him even more attention in the press.
Nick DeNoia is producer and manager of the Chippendales Men. Under his direction, what should have been a passing fancy is now a multi-million dollar industry.
So Nick and Steve proved to be very effective partners in building this business, but almost from the start, they had this brewing rivalry between them.
They were the wrong two people to work together.
That relationship was toxic.
At this point, Steve Banerjee is raking in $8 million a year.
But there's some dark underpinnings here, and added into that mix is Nick DeNoia. Much of the reason of Chippendale's success is due to Nick, and the tension is starting to simmer.
There were these two kinds of completely opposite people. Nick is very artistic. Steve was very business-minded.
Nick is better looking, he's more charismatic, and Steve is known to be socially awkward, and it's starting to come to a head. And on top of that, Nick is getting ready to expand to New York with a club that's going to be bigger and better than the LA club.
The New York audience is theater aware, and they understand what it is we're doing theatrically.
As Nick was getting ready to open the New York club, it started to fall apart a little bit with Steve. Steve wanted to give input into how the show should be performed. This was like telling a mother how to birth her baby.
They saw things differently. Nick came from what's best for the production. Steve came from what pretty boy is going to sell more. I don't care if he can't dance or walk and chew gum. So you had this kind of fighting all the time, and it would get caustic, it would get vulgar.
Chippendales New York opens to incredible fanfare.
We love it, it's great, we're having a great time.
The men are allowed to go wherever they want, why can't ladies?
What we've created here is an equal opportunity fantasy factory.
Compared to Chippendales in LA, it was huge. It looked like a basketball arena with seats on both sides.
And on the East Coast, the celebrity factor kicks in.
Andy Warhol came in, John Travolta. Brooke Shields celebrated her birthday at our club.
Chippendales became press darlings. We're talking about constant bookings on daytime talk shows.
From New York City, here are the Chippendales, right here.
It was pretty much every talk show. I mean, Regis and Kathy Lee.
Hunks and more hunks.
Sally, Jesse, Raphael, Donahue. So there was so much national attention.
You liked it. Your grandchildren are watching.
This stuff was made to order for those shows.
Chippendales became a household name.
We were the Beatles without the talent.
Women who might never have heard of Chippendales would flip on their TV and they might see Chippendales Men dancing and stripping before a national audience.
Yes, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to know what method you use to get such hairless chests.
Yeah, there's not too many hairs on those chests.
You don't see a lot of grass on the playground, right?
There was definitely a lot of sex going on. That was like the icing on the cake. You know, I'm making a ton of money. I'm working 2 hours a night. This is the life.
As the dancers became well known in their own right, so does Nick DeNoia.
Meet the brains behind the brawn, Nick DeNoia.
It was at one of those sleazy little clubs on Overland Avenue, and I said, wow, there's a big audience out there. Let's figure out what the women want.
And he would often be credited as the founder of Chippendales
which enrages Steve.
I do remember Steve saying many times, who does this guy think he is? I made him. He's lucky to work for me.
Steve Banerjee was virtually invisible.
Steve, as he saw Nick take his brand to greater and greater heights and to greater popularity, he became more resentful of Nick and tried to kind of tighten the reins on him.
Banerjee is really jealous and angry with DeNoia, and they go through this restructuring. Ultimately, it's going to go bad.
Steve has a reputation for being super cheap at Chippendales, always pinching pennies beyond what's reasonable.
Steve Banerjee was tight, 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 and tight.
He was a miser, to put it officially. Any opportunity he could find not to pay somebody or tear up that check, he loved finding it.
Why not screw them if you think you can get away with it, was Steve's philosophy.
There's this fateful moment in Chippendale's history, which is known as the napkin deal.
In business mythology, you hear someone was signed because of a napkin deal. Someone was discovered, and it was the start of their big career. But for the most part, legitimate business deals don't take place on napkins. And this napkin deal is a classic example of why it's just not a good idea.
Steve and I, we were out to dinner and Nick came.
Nick and Steve were really at each other's throats. And so they're trying to work out a deal for the future of the business.
DeNoia wants the success he's brought to the business to be acknowledged financially.
And Nick DeNoia said, look, if you're not gonna give me more money, let me at least take this show on the road and I can make some money that way.
At this point, there was no tour. Nick knew that this was something he wanted to do, but it didn't exist yet.
DeNoia proposes that he'll have complete creative control over the touring and he'll get 50% of the profits.
Nick basically wrote he had the rights to take the show on the road in perpetuity, and he signed it.
Banerjee didn't think the tour was worth anything, and he quickly signed that off.
Part of the key to the napkin deal is that it included the phrase in perpetuity.
After everything was done, Nick had left and Steve asked and he said, what's perpetuity? And I said, it's forever and ever.
DeNoia gains rights to the touring show, which Banerjee has no idea is going to be worth something.
That deal would definitely come to haunt Steve.
It's pretty amazing to think that this agreement scribbled off on a napkin changed the course of Chippendale's history and ruined lives.
That is where the Chippendale world fell apart.
Nick is laughing all the way to the bank.
I'm sure Steve thought, that's my money. He's taking my money.
This is the kind of thing that makes Steve Banerjee seethe. It festers inside of him. Thanks to the deal signed on a napkin, Nick DeNoia has the right to take Chippendales on tour, and it's about to be a wild success.
You're ready to rock and roll.
You're on two shows a night, every night. You may have a day off, maybe one day off.
Oh, God, were they successful. Oh, my God. There was standing room only, no matter where you went on tour, especially out in the Midwest. We used to make such a killing during hunting season because all the women would come to the shows while the guys are out hunting. They're out getting deer, and they're getting us.
DeNoia has built a very successful touring business. He's printing money and bringing in hundreds of women to these venues.
I'm sure that really ticked off Steve Banerjee. I'm sure Steve thought, that's my money. He's taking my money.
Steve Banerjee feels as though he's been duped out of profits by Nick DeNoia thanks to that ill-fated napkin deal, but there's one thing he has in his domain. The Chippendales calendars. He's got complete control of those.
They're one of the most profitable revenue sources for Chippendales.
He was selling counters like rock stars sell albums. He was going platinum with calendars.
For years, calendars for men existed, featuring scantily clad women. But now Chippendales is flipping the script once again, pioneering a whole new type of calendar.
Here it is, hot off the press, the 1985 Chippendales calendar.
Mr. January, ladies and gentlemen, Michael Rapp.
All the ladies here today are going to get the Chippendale calendar.
The calendars became a big deal. Even if you didn't feel like you had the wherewithal to make it to a show, you could get some of the same fun out of buying a calendar or giving a calendar to somebody.
The Chippendale calendar covers were just kind of incredible. They're like greased up, super tan, super ripped.
That was January. That really put you on the map if you were in a calendar.
We were in Mexico. It was sort of the Sahara Desert look.
I was born in October, so I was October. I was lucky enough to have that month.
Banerjee loved the calendar business because it was fast money.
Remember, his own father had run his own printing company in India.
He was always trying to emulate his father.
He wanted his calendar to be beautiful. I think that for him, it was a reflection of where he came from and who he was. It's 1986, and Steve Banerjee is working on the 1987 Chippendales calendar.
Something really bad happens. It really is a huge and terrible turning point for Steve Banerjee.
Steve has a deadline to get the layout of the calendars done.
They show up to the agency who is designing the whole layout, and they're asking for the proof, which is what it's going to look like once we print it. And there's only one employee left at the place, and the one employee is like, sorry, it's not ready.
And Banerjee's like, look, just make sure it gets out the door.
A few days later, that test version of the calendar shows up to the office. Steve is supposed to make sure that everything in the calendar is accurate. He signs off on it, and then it goes to the printers.
And so they print 800,000 copies of this calendar. And a short while later, the calendars show up.
I'm in his office with him, and this kid from the warehouse comes running in with boxes of calendars. He says, I see something here in this calendar. And the kid shows him the month of February. There shouldn't be 31 days in February, Steve. And he's like, what? And his eyes, they just jumped like out of a cartoon. They just jumped out of a socket. Sure enough, every box they opened, every calendar had 31 days in February. And Steve was like, holy.
When these were delivered, they were useless.
31 days in February? I don't think so. May has 31 days, not 30.
We thought it was hysterical, actually. That's a big mistake.
When you're a son of a printer and you printed bad calendars, it's the worst mistake you can make, and it's humiliating.
It's a very expensive mistake. Banerjee is now on the hook for reprinting all of these calendars, and it's going to set him back $700,000.
This is the kind of thing that makes Steve Banerjee seethe. It festers inside of him. For someone who's a notorious miser, he's out a lot of money. And so who does he channel that anger to but Nick DeNoia, the guy he thinks is ripping him off thanks to that napkin deal.
And even though Nick had nothing to do with the calendar mishap, Steve was so hurt and angry from that experience and channeled all his anger towards Nick.
I thought they were going to come to blows. I thought they were going to hit each other.
What will come next would be far, far worse than a fist fight.
A man has been shot in the head in my office.
Steve is still reeling from that costly calendar mistake, and he's tortured by the success of Nick's tour. So he decides to start his own.
Steve was sending his dancers out on the road, and he was not supposed to do that by the terms of the napkin deal. Nick is enraged, and that only ramps up the tension between them.
I heard him talking on the phone and saying, you know, Banerjee, screw him, that money's mine. When you start hearing that stuff like that about money, you know, things are going south.
Finally, Nick goes to court and he gets an order shutting down Banerjee's rival Chippendales tour.
I think Banerjee was feeling like I'm suffocating now. And now I still got this guy out there milking my dream.
Now Nick has reached a breaking point. He decides he's going to start his own male exotic dance troupe, completely separate from Chippendales.
I think Nick thought that he could blow Chippendales out of the water.
But remember, Nick still owns the rights to the Chippendales tour. So even as he starts competing with Chippendales, he will still rake in the money from the road shows. And this is the ultimate blow to Steve.
And Nick had an idea for his own calendar. The calendar was to be produced with a vellum overlay, whereby you would first see the dancer dressed, lift up the vellum, and then underneath was the exact same picture, but he only has on a G-string.
Nick is, at this point, trying to do his own thing and cast his own show out of this office in Times Square. Times Square in the mid-1980s is not what it is today. Summertime is here, and it's a home vibe. Everybody get outside. It was full of peep shows. There was pretty high crime in that area.
He shares a small office with two talent agents that he knows. One is Will Mott, the other is Robin Boris.
I absolutely had a crush on Nick. He was incredibly charming. I know about the conflict between himself and Steve. I could hear what was going on in his office. I could feel a conflict coming to a head.
On April 7th, 1987, Steve Banerjee is in LA, and Nick is in New York City working in his office.
I came in at around 9 o'clock in the morning and Will was already there, Nick was there. We had an appointment for a client to take a meeting, and initially Will was supposed to go and then he wasn't feeling well, and so I offered to go. My client and I went to the meeting.
While Robin is out, this man comes up to the 15th floor where their office is and walks in.
And looks at Will and says, are you Nick DeNoia? And Will says, no, I'm not, but he's right back there. The guy doesn't go to Nick's office, but turns around and goes into the hallway.
And then, mayhem.
Will hears a gunshot. And he knows something terrible has happened. Will comes into Nick's office and he sees him there, slumped back in his chair.
A man has been shot in the head in my office.
Okay, is he conscious?
No. Oh my God.
I walked back up to the building. There was police tape everywhere and there were a lot of cops. And I called the office and Will answered the phone and he said, they've shot Nick. And I said, who shot Nick?
New York City police are trying to determine the motive in the murder of an award-winning television producer and choreographer. Investigators say there was no sign of a robbery or struggle.
DeNoia's death was just the beginning.
And you would have never thought Chippendales would be surrounded with murder.
During the hunt for Nick's killer, things get even more dangerous. There's a hit list on Chippendales who leave for other groups. Really? Somebody's going to kill me for this? For a male exotic show, you're going to kill two people?
The plans allegedly involved murder by cyanide poisoning.
I slept with a knife under my bed.
One of the most bizarre murder-for-hire cases in the history of the FBI.
You wouldn't have never thought Chippendales would be surrounded with murder.
You've got two men, couldn't have come from two more different worlds.
Steve started Chippendales, but Nick was the one who made it an artistic endeavor.
And their fight to the finish is at the center of a new true crime series on Hulu entitled Welcome to Chippendales.
I am the boss, this is my club, and you are my employee.
Steve felt that part of solving problems was to make people disappear.
Somebody's gonna kill me for this? For a male exotic show, you're gonna kill two people?
We have to call the cops.
No, we do not call the cops!
Okay, forget about all the fun stuff. Let me tell you the part you don't know, because nobody has ever heard the real facts. Behind the huge success of Chippendales were two men with opposite personalities. Steve Banerjee and Nick DeNoia.
Steve was quiet and was very business focused.
He often would hang in the shadows at the club.
Nick, on the other hand, was loud and gregarious.
This manic thinker who was such a perfectionist and had so many big ideas.
And so that's where the story gets really juicy. Two strong-minded guys, enormous success. There's going to be conflict, and there really was. So it's not surprising that Hulu has a scripted limited series called Welcome to Chippendales that dramatizes the relationship between these two combustible people.
You had them call you Mr. Chippendales.
Excuse me?
And the same thing happened on Donahue. They called you Mr. Chippendales.
Oh, and you think that I told them to call me that?
Well, you certainly did not object.
Oscar and Emmy-nominated Kumail Nanjiani plays the man himself, Steve Banerjee, and Emmy winner Murray Bartlett plays his adversary, Nick DeNoia.
Listen, Steve, if it wasn't for me, you'd be a failed nightclub owner living out of the trunk of your car.
Okay.
And if it wasn't for me, you'd still be doing unicorn deals. I forbid you from going on national television to take credit for my creation. Oh, is that
what I'm doing? Is that what I'm doing, Steve? I'm stealing credit?
That's exactly what you are doing!
Both of them thought that they were the reason that Chippendales was successful. And I think that's where the clash came from. Steve knew he would not be successful without Nick, and I think he hated Nick for that.
You've got two choices. You and me stick together and take the Big Apple by storm. Or you and me go to war, and I become your biggest competitor and worst nightmare. It will be ugly, Steve.
In playing the character, the visual I thought of was a little flame inside a block of ice. And his entire body is working to make sure that that fire doesn't get out.
But sometimes that fire does get out.
I am the boss! This is my club! And you are my employee! Is that clear?
By 1987, the perfect partnership had given way to tension over profits and creative control.
And now, Nick DeNoia is dead.
A man has been shot.
What's the name of your place?
This is Chippendales Universal.
Oh, wow.
New York City police are trying to determine the motive in the murder of an award-winning television producer and choreographer. The victim, Nicholas DeNoia, was shot to death in his office.
Nick DeNoia was a tragic thing.
The world lost a generous, crazy, loving person.
He was like my dad, and he was brilliant.
So it was a very traumatic time for everyone. It has traumatized all of us.
It killed me. Killed us all.
When the NYPD first started investigating Nick's murder, they wondered, could this have been a break-in? Could this have been a lover's quarrel?
Is this a robbery? Is this a burglary? But nothing was missing, right? Is this a random crime? But why come up 15 flights and kill a person in an inner interior office?
Was it a business dispute gone wrong?
At this point, it's a whodunit and why.
Well, police so far have been closed-mouthed about this particular crime. Apparently, Mr. DeNoia knew his killer. There were no signs of a struggle. The question now is who the killer was and why he would want Nick DeNoia dead.
In the late 1980s, early 1990s, the murder rate in New York City was really high. And look, if you don't solve a murder within the first 48 to 72 hours, you're probably not going to solve it.
Turns out, not everyone was a fan of Nick DeNoia.
Detectives had come into the club. We were rehearsing and questioned us about who would want to kill Nick. And I, because I can't shut my mouth, kind of mumbled under my breath, who wouldn't?
Evening Magazine had interviewed Nick at a rehearsal.
If you give me what I want, I'm a sweetheart. The only time you have trouble with me is when you make me break your back.
A lot of them, in painting a picture of who Nick was, said things like, well, there are a lot of people who probably would have wanted to kill Nick DeNoia because he was such a tough customer.
You know, there were a lot of rumors around a lot of people.
I know they talked to us several times.
I think they zigzagged a lot.
Then it went to an ex-lover.
Afterwards, I heard they were interviewing some people Nick might have been seeing.
None of those led to anything concrete.
Then it went to the mob.
In the 80s, the mob was a little more prevalent than it is today.
We had connections with the mafia, especially in New York, to pay for so-called protection.
Banerjee felt he was being extorted by the mafia in New York.
The first night I was there, me and Steve, we went out to a club, and he said, you know, I don't like this in New York. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? You're making tons of money. It's like a couple thousand girls in there. Yeah, but mafia, they get the door and give me what they think I should have.
There was definitely an undercurrent of organized crime in Banerjee's life, and it was a tough case.
But why would the mob kill Nick if they were allegedly making money off the New York City club?
When the detective interviewed me at the funeral, the first thing I told him is maybe you should talk to Steve Banerjee.
My first words were, Steve Banerjee did it.
It seemed so obvious to me, right? Follow the money.
The NYPD made efforts, but they just couldn't find any evidence.
NYPD called Banerjee on the phone to try and get a statement from him. He's in LA, he's got an alibi.
I got a call from an officer asking me questions. I go, there's Steve Banerjee. He goes, no, he's already cleared. He was in a restaurant in LA.
When you believe in a story and they don't arrest him, then after a while you're thinking, well, maybe you're wrong.
Then it was almost like it never even happened. It seemed like Nick got written off as some guy who had been in a seedy nightclub business. Isn't this just one of those things?
As the murder investigation drags on, Banerjee has sole control of the business again. But new trouble is ahead.
The LA club is in trouble.
Intentional disregard of the law.
He couldn't get a license. He was done.
Chippendales is having me follow. I was shocked.
I knew he would think himself invincible.
He was just pissed off at this guy. He just wanted him dead.
You know what? Nothing stays secret forever.
Despite the murder of Nick DeNoia, the Chippendales clubs in New York and LA are still going strong.
Steve Banerjee continued to make money from all of his ventures, from the clubs, from the calendars.
This is a great place for a lot of fun and crazy women.
Banerjee was able to buy back Nick's share of the touring rights from Nick's family, and the show just went on.
There's a scene in Evita where money just comes pouring from heaven. And that was us.
He would make $25,000, $30,000. He would make that in a night.
All you have to do is reach into your purse or pocket and grab a tip for your favorite dancer.
I went to Steve's house once. I walk in his bedroom, and here's a safe, 3x3, filled to the brim with money.
You can't become that successful and that rich without being just absolutely ruthless.
Steve Banerjee is living large.
Steve Banerjee will risk his life, anything, just to get the shot he wants.
Been really enjoying the success of Chippendales, which only continues to grow.
But at the same time, the LA club is in trouble. Dogged by violations, by lawsuits, going back to the earliest days in the club.
Severe overcrowding, intentional disregard of the law, it's unacceptable.
Those weren't the club's only problems with the law. One significant case began 4 years before Nick DeNoia's death.
Steve was being sued for a lot of different things, and one of the things he was sued for is he wouldn't let blacks in the club.
After the show for women was over, they let men come in. Banerjee loved that equation because that meant more bar sales, but...
he would make the black guys stand in a line to the side, and he would tell the doorman, look, don't let him in.
Here's a man who believed that if he had too many black men in a club, white women wouldn't go.
You can't do that. You can't. That's discrimination.
He didn't care what the legal ramifications are until it became too late.
In the early 80s, Don Gibson was a young law student in LA who decided to create a sting operation.
My friends, Greg and Ben, were both white males. We met at my apartment, and I made sure that I was better dressed than they were. And we took photographs of ourselves just to have that empirical evidence. So when we arrived at Chippendales, I approached a doorman who was white, very muscular, well-built man. I took out my California ID card. He said, no, you need a membership card. I said, where can I get a membership card? I didn't know you needed one. Ben and Greg walked up to the same doorman. No questions asked, they were let in. They came back out, they were so incensed, so upset. This is Los Angeles, a diverse community, and here is this blatant racism being carried out by this nightclub right in my neighborhood. We approached the doorman, and they pointed to me and said he was denied admission because he was black. The doorman looked at me and said, no, he was denied admission because he did not have a membership card. And they put out their hands, which had a stamp showing that they were admitted. And they looked at him and said, neither did we. And his jaw dropped. And at that point, we said, you'll be hearing more from us.
They filed a complaint.
Two different state agencies were investigating allegations of racial discrimination by Chippendales, including the alleged use of quotas to limit the number of black men admitted to the club.
Don actually goes to a hearing about his case, and there's Steve Banerjee, whose skin is practically as dark as Don's.
I walked over to him, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, I just want you to know that my grandfather is from Bombay and looks just like you. And I walked away.
In response to the complaint, Chippendales said it did not racially discriminate against those looking to get into the club and denied it did so in Don's case. But the investigations continued.
Steve felt that part of solving problems was to make people disappear. When he felt that he was gonna lose, he was just pissed off at this guy. He just wanted him dead.
While Don Gibson is waiting for the state agencies to complete their investigations, he receives an unsettling call.
An employee at a rental car agency finds paperwork in a car with Don Gibson's name on it. He contacts Don and gives it to him.
It turned out to be a log of a private investigator who was working for Chippendales. Chippendales is having me followed. I couldn't believe it, I was shocked.
According to a Chippendales employee, Banerjee planned to hire a sex worker to pick Gibson up and frame him by planting drugs. Then he planned to blackmail Gibson to change his story in order to clear Chippendales.
I'm thinking that he could easily get this guy killed. Do I say something?
I got a phone call from someone named Hadari. And he said, I am the only black dancer at Chippendales, and I'm calling you to tell you that your life is in danger.
You just gotta be careful, because Steve, he's verbalized that it might be to his advantage if you weren't around, so.
Scared the out of us. I do think Hadari potentially saved my life.
Don Gibson's attorneys filed a federal class action lawsuit.
While Chippendales denied any wrongdoing, the company agreed to settle the case by paying $85,000 in damages and committing to hire more black employees.
In the years that followed, continued safety violations and allegations of sexual discrimination against the club threatened its survival.
In spite of repeatedly being fined and brought into court, they have repeatedly not paid attention to that.
The Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control has had enough, and they revoked the liquor license for the original LA club.
He couldn't get a license anymore to serve alcohol. He was done.
In 1988, the original club on Overland Avenue shuts down.
Fire commission closed down the club due to too many cases of overcrowding.
He still had New York, but LA was done.
But Steve Banerjee was about to go on the offensive in ways no one could have imagined.
Banerjee was very aware of copycat groups.
Banerjee was certainly becoming paranoid.
There was a time when I slept with a knife under my bed.
There was murder and arson and greed, and probably one of the most bizarre murder-for-hire cases in the history of the FBI.
Closure of the LA club, the Chippendales were still flourishing in New York City and in road shows across the country. Everybody knew the name Chippendales.
Either one of you would make a fine addition to the Chippendale family.
Enough to warrant actually being parodied on Saturday Night Live.
Of course, that's my favorite SNL sketch with Patrick Swayze and Chris Farley.
Patrick Swayze would have hired him in a heartbeat to be a Chippendale, no problem.
Farley? Yeah, maybe a host.
Despite all of his success, Banerjee still had grander dreams of global domination.
In 1991, I was getting stalked by an American guy who had come from Los Angeles who kept wanting to have meetings with me, and they had a troupe of dancers called the Chippendales, which he wanted to bring to Europe.
Steve Banerjee is introduced to a heavy-duty music agent, a guy named Carl Leighton Pope.
Carl had Bryan Adams, Van Morrison, and Deep Purple, and the guys from Squeeze.
Steve Banerjee took me to his club. And I wasn't about to do some kind of pseudo-sex show.
Ladies, what do you want him to do?
It was just the most extraordinary thing to see, but it wasn't for me.
Wipe your chin off. Shame on you. Look at that. What a mess.
But then a friend has an idea for him, which is that in Europe, they should make the show not a nightclub act, but this could be a stage show. This could be a theatrical production. Feeling so good
now. I thought, yo, lovely. What do? What do they sing? And he said, they don't sing. They take their clothes off, and we're going to represent them.
Chippendales London Calling, the ultimate ladies' night out, a musical with muscle.
We had a show at the Strand Theatre in London, and they had put this amazingly ridiculous poster on the front of the building that you could see from almost anywhere in London. That was creating quite a buzz.
So we took 3 weeks. And it sold out.
And they were just instantly famous and instantly a hit.
The madness in the audience was almost like with the Beatles. They were just going absolutely crazy. It was about an American accent. Girls want to hear a guy say,
have a nice day. And they were gentlemen, and that's what made Chippendales great. And I thought, I need another troupe. So I called Banerjee and said, I need another show. They put a show together, sent it over to me, and we put them on the road. And they started to do ridiculous business. Boom. Then the Belgians called, then the French called, then the Germans started calling.
Holland was a very big place. The Scandinavian countries, definitely. Denmark, Sweden. At one point, I had 120 Chippendales touring in five groups around Europe.
It was just unbelievable. It was pandemonium. As far as Steve Banerjee was concerned, it was all about business.
There were rival groups popping up that Banerjee saw as copycats.
One of them was this group Adonis, which was created by a couple of former Chippendales dancers.
I left them in 91 to go to Adonis. You had several dancers that were on tours with Chippendales, backup dancers, so you had a lot of ex-Chippendalers in the group.
Adonis, this rival troupe, is booked to play Blackpool, which is this resort town in the UK.
The place is crowded. It's Blackpool. It's the Atlantic City of England, and the crowds are great, and they're screaming, and I'm going, okay, let's do this.
Banerjee was starting to talk to us more about what are these guys doing, what business is this guy doing, and he was certainly becoming paranoid, and I thought, this is a nonsense. How much bigger do you want the Chippendales to be before you realize that it's us, it's not even gonna be anybody else? Stop it.
In Steve's eyes, he wanted to be the only male exotic dance troupe in town.
As Reed Scott took the stage in Blackpool, he had no idea the terrifying experience that was about to transpire. He tells his story in an exclusive interview with the Discovery Plus series, Curse of the Chippendales.
One night, I was just getting into the show, and all of a sudden, the producer and the promoter of the show comes over and he asked me to step down off the stage. He said, you need to come down, we gotta talk.
A detective shows up and has to sit down the dancers and their tour manager.
He said, we have intercepted a call that there has been a contract put on your life. Somebody wants to kill you. How? They said cyanide injection.
Cyanide.
A syringe full of cyanide.
The murderers decide to use cyanide.
And that's when it just gets really dark, really quick. It was like I was just punched right in the face with like a construction demolition ball. I mean, it just was 10 tons of just impact. Stopped me dead in the tracks. I'm just boom. When I first learned how the murder was going to be a cyanide injection, then it became real.
In England, the men of Adonis continued to perform while knowing that someone had hired a hitman to kill them.
It doesn't take a lot of cyanide. It would be a quick jab, a sting, it's done, you're gone. In England, I slept with a knife under my bed. The bathroom door would be open, a light would always be on. I'm waiting for somebody to come in. I'm scared to death. What about your son? What about your family? And I said, Banerjee. It's got to be Banerjee.
The FBI in Las Vegas gets a call from a man who goes by the name Strawberry. Strawberry is an FBI informant who has a bizarre story to tell.
Strawberry tells the FBI that he was hired by somebody to go to Blackpool with cyanide
to take out three exotic male dancers who dance under the name of Adonis in the UK.
The way he was supposed to kill them was by injecting them with cyanide.
The FBI, of course, wants to know who hired Strawberry. That person is Ray Colon.
Ray Colon was a muscle guy for the mob. A very charming guy. He could walk into any place and talk to anybody. You know, how you doing? How are you? And he would talk to you about everything and anything, about the day, how's it going? It's like you knew this guy for years. The very charming charisma with a kind of threatening subtext. Don't mess with me.
In 1978, Ray Colone walks to Chippendales, meets Steve Banerjee, and Ray becomes Steve's go-to guy whenever he needs to get something done. That something could mean installing new sound equipment at the club, or it could be more nefarious things like, say, setting a rival club on fire.
Agents in Los Angeles head up to Colone's house in Santa Clarita. They conduct a search warrant on the premises. And lo and behold, what do they find?
There is a bag with a skull and crossbones on it, like out of a movie or something.
The skull and crossbones are literally hand-drawn. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Inside is all of this cyanide.
46 grams of cyanide, enough to kill 230 people. They arrest Ray, and after sitting in jail for about 7 months, he decides to fully cooperate with the FBI and tell his story.
Colone not only provides all this information on the Adonis hit, he also provides all of this information on the related Nick DeNoia murder. And he links them together in a way that no one had at that point, which is Steve Banerjee. He's the man at the top of the pile. He's the one who's hired Ray to carry out these hits.
And Ray tells the FBI how Steve Banerjee asked him to hire someone to kill Nick DeNoia.
He said, I want someone murdered. I said, are you out of your mind?
Ray appears in this 1998 British documentary, Chippendales, A Secret History.
Although Ray appears in silhouette, the documentary identifies him by name.
And I said, no, that ain't gonna happen, Steve. He said, come on, man, you know, you do the right thing for your friend.
Banerjee tells Colone, if you don't do this, I'm gonna have the mafia take care of you.
He says, come on, just get someone to do it. This guy, DeNoia, is killing me, you know. He's taking millions from me, you know. And I guess that's when I sold my soul.
Ray Colone reveals that he was the middleman in Nick DeNoia's murder. He hired Gilberto Rivera Lopez to pull the trigger. Turns out Rivera Lopez is already in prison for an unrelated crime.
The golden goose, so to speak, is Steve Banerjee, the owner of Chippendales.
Now they gotta get Steve Banerjee on tape, and it's like off to the races.
The FBI arranges for Ray Colone's release from prison to work as an undercover informant.
The day we get Colone out, I happen to be wearing a 5-shot on my ankle. I pull it out of my holster. Colone's in the back seat. I reach over the back seat. I say, here, Ray, take this. You might as well put a bullet in my head because I'm a 3-year agent. If you screw us over and run on us, I'm going to lose my career. So you might as well just kill us right now because you're going to f*** us over.
It's a daring move, handing a gun to a confessed criminal.
Part of my style is to bend the rules as far as they can go without breaking them. Colone says, are you guys crazy? I've told you already. I'm with you guys 200%. I want to get this guy.
So the FBI and Ray start to contact Steve.
Banerjee was not keen on talking on the phone, which becomes a problem for us.
The police face a real issue, particularly with Steve Banerjee. He's so paranoid. I mean, this is a guy who thinks everyone's trying to rip him off. So how are they going to get him to talk freely about his role in these crimes?
The plan is that Ray is going to tell Banerjee that he is out of jail so he could get treatment for his kidney disease, which is a real illness that Ray was suffering from at the time.
Finally, Ray convinces Steve to meet, and they decide to meet at a IHOP in Santa Monica.
We're excited about the prospects of this meeting. We have a recording device on Colone. We need a good, clear conversation of the two of them reliving the past, the arsons, the murder. So this is the best shot that we had. We sent him into the meeting, and Colone is immediately directed into the restroom. Banerjee puts his finger to his lips, tells Colone not to say a word.
Colone starts trying to have a conversation with him. Steve starts writing his answer on post-it notes, showing them to Colone, and then tearing them up and throwing them into the toilet.
Ray is trying to get Steve to mention the murder, to say anything about it, to mention DeNoia.
But Banerjee wasn't biting. We don't capture anything on a recording device. There's a lot of rustling, and you could hear whispered talking. You could hear scratching of a pencil. You just can't hear anything of value. Frustration and more frustration.
Scott Cariola is really at a low point.
I'm on a merry-go-round of emotions.
You need to get a guy to talk, but this guy is so scared of being recorded.
It's like we're playing chess against Banerjee. We make a move, he counters us.
So what Cariola comes up with is so outside the box.
It's a high-stakes plan that could easily end in disaster.
There's a saying in the FBI, be nice to everybody, be kind to everybody, but also have a plan to kill them.
FBI agent Scott Cariola had to resort to unusual methods in his investigation of Steve Banerjee.
We had a major problem was that Banerjee knew Cologne was arrested. It's going to be hard to convince that person on the outside that this person that's in custody is not cooperating with the government. So that's what we had to overcome. It was a major obstacle.
Scott Cariola has this big idea. He is going to get Ray Colon to pretend he's a fugitive from justice, to escape overseas, tell Banerjee he's a fugitive from justice, meet with Banerjee in Europe. So why would he ever suspect that he was being recorded in that circumstance?
And that was the plan we set in motion. I obtained a passport for Colon so that he could travel under an alias name.
FBI agent Cariola is bending the rules again. The FBI doesn't normally take criminals out of the country to work undercover.
Banerjee wanted to meet in Zurich. We got Cologne a disguise that he could wear.
A beret and a mustache to make Banerjee convinced that he's actually a fugitive from justice.
Would you expect a fugitive to do when he was overseas on the run? Maybe, you know, change his appearance a little bit.
Steve compliments him on how different he looks, very European, as if he's been on the run for quite a while.
Cologne and Banerjee dispatched to a hotel room.
The FBI have the rooms on either side of Ray's supposed hideout room.
This is absolutely a do or die situation. If Banerjee doesn't give us what we need in this conversation, what's the plan? I mean, this has to work.
Ray has taken the strategy that instead of bringing up the murder, which might spook Steve, he instead tries to talk about other things and hope that Steve will bring it up.
And I'm sitting there with the headphones on and I've got my legal pad out. I wanted to make sure that if this recording device failed, I could at least testify to what I overheard.
Steve says his life is horrible because he's constantly afraid he's going to get arrested. He talks about possibly going on the lam and fleeing to India.
He told Cologne that there's nothing more important to Banerjee after the dollar than his freedom. I mean, the conversation went on for 3 or 4 hours. I mean, we're all exhausted at this point. We're going way past midnight. Cologne is drinking. Banerjee's commenting about how much Cologne can drink, but I'm sure Cologne's drinking a lot because he's nervous as heck.
Steve also says that the walls in the hotel are super thin, so he's afraid the FBI are listening in from the next room, and Ray pounds on the wall to show how solid they are, even though the FBI really are in the next room listening in.
Banerjee had not let go of his paranoia. He's actually meeting with Cologne in part to assuage some of that paranoia.
Banerjee's desperate. The thing he really wants to know is if the FBI mentioned anything to Cologne about the deed. That's what was the code word that they used for the murder of Denoya. They would call it the deed for Denoya's name.
In that point, Steve starts talking about the murder and how it's not linked to him.
And then Banerjee says to Cologne, do they know about the deed?
Banerjee specifically asked, and I recall as clear as a bell, did they ask you about the deed? And then Banerjee asked Cologne, do they know that I gave you the money to buy the guns?
That that is the moment when Cologne and certainly Gariola know that they've got him. He has confessed to purchasing the guns and setting up the hit of Nick DeNoia.
And the conversations were perfect. Exactly what we needed to hear Banerjee say on tape.
The FBI now has enough to arrest Steve Banerjee.
But Banerjee did something that would shock all of them.
Steve Banerjee is behind bars tonight.
Accused of hiring somebody to kill three of his former business associates.
Steve Banerjee was constantly worried he was going to be arrested.
Now he has also been charged with racketeering by federal prosecutors.
And now the time had finally come.
If convicted, Banerjee faces life in prison and a $1.75 million fine.
Banerjee ends up getting charged on 8 counts.
Banerjee was denied bail late today. Prosecutors are voicing suspicions that he might try to flee the country.
Now I'm thinking to myself that how the hell is Banerjee gonna do time? He is not really cut out for that kind of life.
When the summer of 1994, Banerjee and his lawyers finally make a plea, which is accepted by the court.
Are you kidding? A plea deal? He murdered my buddy. No.
His plea deal requires that he be sentenced to 26 years in prison. But what was also devastating for Steve Banerjee is that he would lose ownership of Chippendales.
On the day of his sentencing, I got Clark Wilson, the MC.
Because we wanted to see him go down.
I was expecting to come here today and see Stephen Banerjee in shackles.
We sat down there and we're waiting, and it was a very long time before somebody came in and said there will be no sentencing today.
Banerjee was found hanging in his jail cell.
My immediate reaction was anger.
He got to choose his time, and Nick didn't get to choose his time, and somehow it still doesn't seem right.
He cheated the justice system. He cheated all of us.
Some speculate this was one final scheme by Banerjee.
His biggest fear was anybody having a piece of Chippendales.
By killing himself, all his assets go to his family instead of the government.
So while Steve Banerjee's family did inherit Chippendales, the company has been sold a few times since.
Gilbert Lopez Rivera, who was the person who actually killed Nick DeNoia, was eventually convicted of homicide. He was sentenced to 25 years to life. Cologne got a reduced sentence for his cooperation.
He served over 2 years in federal prison and house arrest before he was released in 1996. And the Chippendales, well, almost 40 years later and under new ownership, the dance troupe survived that period of darkness and tragedy, even thrived. Of course, those white cuffs and collars still remain.
So now Chippendales can be found in Las Vegas at Rio Hotel and Casino, where they really do occupy the exalted chair of the perfect bachelorette party destination.
As the fascination with Chippendales continues, hit movies have been inspired by the dance troupe. It's raining men. Hallelujah,
it's raining men. So there's a documentary series called Curse of the Chippendales that's currently airing on Discovery Plus.
A world of luxury, right at your fingertips. Sheer opulence.
Sheer opulence.
And on Hulu, there's a scripted series called Welcome to Chippendales that's getting a fair amount of buzz right now.
Welcome to Chippendales is a wild true crime saga.
The most famous strip club in the world.
This project is really fun.
So the scripted series is a dramatized account of some of the early days of Chippendales. And it stars Kumail Nanjiani, who is an Academy Award nominee for The Big Sick and who's familiar to a lot of people, for his role on Silicon Valley.
Juliet, straight ahead! Juliet.
And it's also got Juliette Lewis, an Oscar nominee, as a costume designer.
People are scared. Their hearts should be beating. They're alive. They feel alive.
Also in the cast, Annalee Ashford plays Steve's wife.
You are a good person. We don't do things like this.
It's really kind of a swerve for Kumail Nanjiani because we've not really seen him play the bad guy before. And this,
I am the boss,
is a bad guy.
You're a bad man, Mr. Banerjee.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
I felt like it really spoke to a lot of themes that I think about a lot in my life. I'm an immigrant to America. Steve Banerjee was an immigrant to America. We both tried to make it in worlds that weren't really built for our success. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was the idea of success, more is always better. I think Steve fell into that trap too. If he had stopped at a certain point, he had a lot of success. That would have been okay, but he wanted more. I realized the power of Chippendales. The reaction that people have to the performance itself is so powerful, it's so kinetic. It's really kind of explosive. I think there's a fascination with Chippendales because of the contrast between sort of the fun, campy performance and then the behind-the-scenes aspect that's so dark. I think that's what really grabs people.
And for another look at the Chippendales story, the scripted series called Welcome to Chippendales is now streaming on Hulu. That's our program for tonight. I'm David Muir. From all of us here at 2020 and ABC News, good night.